Hey, y'all. Welcome to Questions You Didn't Ask. Did you know that this very spot could be showcasing your business or event? Whether it's an audio ad on our podcast or a visual ad on our new YouTube station or even both, we've got the space for you. Nyesha Frey Consulting is reaching a growing audience of over 1,000 leaders who are passionate about health equity, social justice, and civil rights activism. These are professionals just like you, working across higher education, research, healthcare, nonprofit, government, and even public health sectors. If you're ready to get your message in front of a dedicated and engaged audience, send me an email at nyeshafreyconsultingllc@gmail.com. Let's talk about how we can help you connect with the people who need to hear about your services and products that advance health equity and wellness. Don't miss out. Get in the mix and let's make an impact together. Welcome back to Questions You Didn't Ask with me, Nyesha Frey, and my guest, Jesse McCoy, as we continue the series, Justice or Just Us, How Law, Health, and Equity Collide in America. Let's pick up where we left off. We've talked about the things that we want. I love what you said. Don't feed yourself to the wolf or wolves, plural. But the other piece is, what are the things that you think are protective factors? What are the things that kind of help people to not have to make those hard decisions that kind of keep them away from the legal system and getting a criminal record?
So it runs the gamut. I think there are some people who, you know, just because of their upbringing or whatever, they have a standard of who they want to be. And they know that that standard is not possible if there's, you know, involved in the criminal justice system, right? Mm-hmm. I also think there's an aspirational element to it of, I mean, we should have reparations. People don't want to talk about it, but reparations need to happen.
We can talk about it.
You know, people can have their own economic power to do the things that they want to do and not have to rely on somebody else's system or employment or, you know, policies or whatever. But, you know, because I don't have much hope that that's going to happen. That means don't ask for it. But I don't have much hope that, you know, our current makeup of government is going to do that. I think the other thing, though, is we are in a beautiful time, even though it doesn't always seem like it when you turn the TV on. Mm-hmm. We're in a beautiful time because now we have so many people who have already broken glass ceilings to this point, right? Mm-hmm. And there are people who, for the most part, are happy to help reach back and pull somebody else up. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to, like before when I was like, oh, I don't know what to do. Who's an attorney? Like, what do you do? Now I go back. So at least there's me. And I know a whole bunch of attorneys who'd be willing to help. You've got science programs. Mm-hmm. You've got medical programs. Like, people want you there. What also is kind of the dirty little secret that folks don't talk about is even the institutions that many of us would write off as being PWI, whatever, they need you. Like, they need you. They need you in the building because we provide a diverse perspective that their students may not ever have heard before and that their systems may not have ever known to challenge before, right?
So I'm going to stop you right there because you know there's an attack on DEI. So you're at a private school, so it probably doesn't affect you the same way as my colleagues. Mm-hmm. I have colleagues that are leaving academic institutions, state-funded academic institution, to go to private institutions so that they can do their work. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be an additional episode probably down the line where we talk a little bit about, you know, the erasure of DEI. But keep going and feel free to jump in on that piece, too. In regard to the PWIs needing our presence and our experience.
They need us. They just like American history, they need us. They don't want us, but they need us, right? So one of the things about DEI erasure, right? Let me take this back. There is a very well-funded guy named Ed Blum who believes that Black people are in places that we don't deserve to be at, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is that he can't outright come out and say Black people are at places that we don't need to be at. Mm-hmm. So what he does is he props up other racial groups, ethnic groups, whatever, to make it seem like we're taking something from them. Right. Mm-hmm. And he goes on this tangent, and it helps that, you know, the court is compromised and, you know, Trumpism is a real thing and all that stuff. So he picked his time to bring a series of different lawsuits that challenged the affirmative action policies that were put in place because Black people were disproportionately not allowed to be admitted into those universities in the numbers that we should. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting case study in and of itself, because for the most recent case that basically we deemed to overturn affirmative action, he propped up the Asian American community. Yep. But if you poll and talk to Asian American students at Harvard and UNC, they didn't even want this, right? This is something that he was trying to prop up to say, oh, well, these Black kids got mm-hmm. your seats. They don't deserve to be there. Now, keep in mind, if you look at the demographics of a Harvard, Black people are not making up large percentages at Harvard.
No, sir.
Right? We aren't. Right?
We're there, but it's not a large percent. Exactly.
It's a multitude of reasons as to why we aren't there, but we certainly aren't taking somebody's seat, right? Like, it's not us. Now, some of our white colleagues, you know, if you've ever heard of things like legacy admissions, people who just get in because their dad built a building or whatever, I mean, that plays a role in it, but nobody wants to talk about that, right? And, mm-hmm. Well, at least Ed Bloom doesn't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, he does this lawsuit. Lawsuit gets tossed out at every level for lack of standing, which is true, because Ed Bloom, you are not Asian American, right? But for some reason, when it gets to the Supreme Court of the United States, not only is he deemed to have standing in the compromise court that we know it is, he is deemed to be correct. And as a result, affirmative action changes. And what does that mean? Well, we had a history of cases all throughout the 90s about admissions policies and guidelines. There's this belief system in the general populace that race indicates additional points towards application and admissions considerations, mm-hmm. right? And for some schools, maybe it did, right? So some schools, they may say, all right, well, you know, we know that there's a history of culturally biased aptitude tests. We need mm-hmm. to make up for that. We mm-hmm. know there's a history of disproportionality as far as white and Black student admittees. We need to combat that. So these schools went out and did very progressive programs to try to diversify their student base. And for the most part, a lot of those programs did achieve some of the diversity efforts. Now, when I say diversity, depending on the group that I'm in, mm-hmm. if diversity is Black people, they'd be like, oh, so they went from 13% to 17%.
Right.
Okay. That's diversity. If it's white people, it's like, wow, we went from, you know, 13 to 17. Like, it depends, right?
Mm-hmm, well, mm-hmm.
We're not talking about 50-50 diversity. Right. We're not talking about that. But one of the things that I've always kind of appreciated in these arguments is that there's obviously a contribution that we have to these campuses. And I'll give you a case in point, right? Some people, like the University of Alabama, right? University of Alabama has a rich history of discrimination and all that. But you know what else University of Alabama got?
What?
A football team that's 80% Black people. So obviously, we're here for something, right? You want us there for something, right? And then on top of that, like, they went years and years before NIL and all that without having to pay people. So you're just getting the spoils of these people coming, and then you send them back home broken or maybe wanting to go to the NFL. And the school keeps all that money and uses it for all the programs that they want to expand to their largely white demographic, right?
There you go.
So there is a need, you know, for us. Now, I'll say we've actually had a number of academic achievements from these institutions as well. But mm-hmm. one of the things about having Black students is Black students tend to be vocal, and they're going to demand to see Black professors, right?
Uh-huh.
Which means you can't just diversify the student body. You have to diversify the faculty. Mm-hmm. And if you diversify the faculty, faculty's going to ask for Black leadership. So mm-hmm. you're going to diversify the administration. And at a certain point, the people who don't want the diversity that they, you know, claim or whatever, secretly were meeting to say, how do we stop it? So mm-hmm. now what we're seeing is the quiet part being said out loud. They're mm-hmm. like, all right, we don't want diversity. We're going to take it off the books. As a matter of fact, while you at it, erase Black history. We don't need that. We need you to forget all this bad stuff we did and just accept it. And further, going back to Ed Blum, when he finished dismantling affirmative action, the next step he did was to try to dismantle, which essentially was successful, dismantle the venture fund. Like, so they were
black together
as venture capitalists. They came together because they weren't accepted in the traditional venture capitalist firms. Mm-hmm. So they did their own thing, which is the American thing to do. If you don't want me, I'll be competition, right? So they did their own thing. Then he went and said, well, now they're racially discriminating. How dare they be successful in black, right?
Bottom line.
Right. So the thing about it is, I hope that anybody who is listening to this understands and appreciates the value that you have. And the fact that, you know, I don't like using words like warfare and stuff like that, because I don't want it to be, you know, like inflammatory,
violent,
but there are people who philosophically feel like they want your talents, but they don't want you. Mm-hmm. And as a people in a community, our job is to say, you can't get one without the other. This isn't 1775 anymore, right? We're going to be here. We're going to be vocal. We're going to have positions to play in this system, and you're going to have to deal with us. And these old archaic notions about who we are, what we can do, have to die out. And if you're not ready to deal with that, okay. I now want to go back and revert to people understanding that HBCUs were created by our forefathers because they knew this was happening already. Uh-huh. They were created because we weren't accepted on those campuses. So You don't have to necessarily force yourself into a door where people don't want you. We got schools that teach you just as well, if not better.
If not better.
That's going to love you, right? Who going to respect you and appreciate you and elevate you to where you want to be, right?
Right, right.
So always, like, all credit is due to HBCUs who have been doing this good work and good labor. And The secret that I found out, particularly when I got, you know, my first day at Florida A&M, the secret I found out is we don't talk enough about diversity amongst Black people, right?
Ooh.
There's a lot of Black diversity. Like, Florida A&M was nations of Black people. We had Asian people, Jamaican people, people from Barbados, all this stuff, people from Africa. Like, we had people from all over. And then even amongst Black Americans, somebody who grew up in Chicago is different from somebody who grew up in Florida, right?
Yeah, it's totally different.
It's a lot of diversity. And we have our own kind of microcosm of issues and relationships and all those things within those lenses as well that we don't often address because we're so busy battling kind of the white mantle when we go out into this American society. So I really thought it was a beautiful thing that for 4 years, you know, my roommate was Filipino. It was a Black dude from the Philippines.
Wow.
Right? It's just to see the diversity and to see that no matter where people were from, they were brilliant, right? Like brilliant folks. And, you know, it helps that you're brilliant and you got swag and all this stuff. Like, you can be cool with your brilliance. You don't have to hide your brilliance, right? So I think those are the things that I really value when it comes to HBCU education.
Right.
And I think that we're going to see more and more, particularly with this upcoming presidential election, we're going to see more and more what the value of that HBCU education does.
If you're enjoying the show as much as we love creating it, consider showing your support by buying us a cup of coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/NaishaFrayO. That's buymeacoffee.com/NaishaFrayO. All one word. Each cup is just $5, and every single one helps us continue to produce, develop, and sustain the high-quality content you've come to expect from Questions You Didn't Ask. Thank you for your continued support, and let's keep the conversation going. All right, so we've been talking a lot about education, entrepreneurship, economic justice as protective factors, you know, to being, you know, falling prey to the criminal justice system and the carceral system. So it sounds like I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to go ahead and go there anyway so we can flesh it out some more for our audience. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that there's a school to prison pipeline? And if so, how does it show up in your work or affect the communities you serve?
Yes. Is that a school to prison fight? Like, absolutely. Right.
Right.
What I'll say is I think that there have been strides made to improve resistance to that. For anybody who went to, particularly if you went to high school in the inner city area in the 90s or early 2000s, it was like we had little small disciplinary issues that were getting referred to the school resource office for prosecution. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to do all that. There may still be a need when it comes to, you know, threats of imminent violence on school campuses or stuff like that. But, you know, little fights, things like that, like some stuff needs to be conflict resolution at the school. But for those who don't know, so school to prison pipeline was the system that was essentially what we deemed to be when these schools report you so that you now have a criminal record. It, for the purpose of, I guess, marking that they did something so they wouldn't be held accountable if something happened, and for the purpose of getting what they call bad actors into the judicial system. But the problem is the judicial system isn't really equipped to deal with that, right? So a lot of times when we will go to court and represent people who are, you know, 16, 15, 16, 17, and the judge was like, well, this is a baby. Like this is a baby. I don't want to throw him in jail. But at the same time, I mean, yeah, he did what you accused him of. So we would have to get creative about things like diversion programs. And what does that look like? Can I set community service up for a 15-year-old who doesn't have transportation to get to the place that the community service is going to be available at, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have since done is it sounds like we've expanded a lot more of the diversion programs. Mm-hmm. However, schools are still, you know, they're not a monolith. So there are some principals who are believing if you do this, you know, get arrested. There are other places that believe in conflict resolution. Ultimately, I guess the second part of that is how does that impact the greater community? Mm-hmm. Well, one, a lot of people appreciate this, particularly for my community. But when you have a criminal record, that's going to impact what jobs you get. If you get to school, if you can go to the military, like all that stuff. And so that's going to, you know, damage your economic empowerment. On top of that, a lot of people aren't always familiar with the steps you have to go through for getting things expunged or whether or not the charge even qualifies for expungement because it's very limited. Right. Mm. So, you know, if you can't qualify for an expungement and it has to sit on your record, then there's kind of this albatross around your neck where there's always going to be somebody who, if you do anything wrong, that's the first thing they go in to pick up, right? And they're trying to use that to characterize what kind of person you are. Like, who are you? And do you deserve to be at this job or in this school or whatever the case may be, right? So there's that. The other thing, once you get older, is that if you ever have to go on any kind of public assistance or seek public housing, well, that could be a barrier to you being able to access housing. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you can't access housing, that means that you have housing instability. If you have housing instability, that means that you either got to rely on a relative to get something done with something. A lot of you got relatives that's tied up and stuff, too. Or you have to, you know, be on your own and figure it out or go to an unscrupulous landlord who's predatory. Mm-hmm. Right. So we want to maximize the options that people from our community have. And the best way to do that is to avoid charges altogether. I know, especially being from the community I'm from, that is easier said than done. I think there's people like to try you all the time. They like to try you and put you in situations that you got to make split second decisions. But one of the things that I've been very active about telling mentees and young people I talk to is understanding the difference between momentary pride versus like true success.
Right.
You could win in the moment, but then go to jail or get a record or whatever.
Yeah.
And now you're losing for the lifetime as opposed to losing for the moment. Like, all right, you know, I'm weak, whatever. You win and then move on and you have a great life. Right. Yes. And again, I know I'm saying this from a period of privilege now. I wouldn't have been right if you checked in with me in 97. You
know, it might have been a totally different answer. Right.
But I'm matured. Right. And I'm hoping that I can bring that maturity factor and perspective into folks who are 16, 17 now, because I have also, just like I've seen very bad things in the world, I've also been blessed to see very good things.
Right.
And it feels so good to be able to sleep at night without keeping one eye open mm-hmm. and, you know, worried about somebody from 2 years ago who just got out coming looking for you. Like, I don't have no worries, man. Like, you,
right.
you know, I do the best I can. I come home, try to raise my kid for a few minutes
yes.
and, you know, enjoy life. And I'm trying to get people to the point where they are like traveling. Like mm-hmm. when you go to other countries and you see that the way we do it here may or may not be the right way to do it. There are other ways right. to do it. There are countries that value the sense of community and values and pride, and countries that don't value work. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just like, if they say we going to the beach at 4 o'clock, they going to the beach at 4 o'clock. Right? They're going right. to enjoy themselves. Where it's supposed right. to be like, I got to get this overtime in. I got to get this extra money.
Because you yeah. have to. I mean, and I think that that's really interesting, you know, how, you know, being able to give back at this phase and say, this is how I got here. And these are the types of decisions that I had to make, or looking back, I realized that the value in these decisions are really, you know, what set me up for success and allowed me to keep moving in this direction. And also just so much weight on a young person in a moment can change your life for better or worse, right? Because yes. for you, the decision that you made to stop and talk to that woman with her daughter who was lost on campus changed your life, right? Absolutely. For the better. So one thing that I'm going to pick your brain about before I go on to my next question is, I have been seeing a lot of conversation, and if you don't feel comfortable answering this question, we can move on. But I think you're equipped. I think you know where I'm going. You'll be fine. What I want to ask about is how young people with disabilities are more vulnerable mm-hmm. to the school to prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have been following my show will recognize that I talk about, you know, Black disability communities a lot on my show. One, because I have a child that has a disability and I grew up in a community that embraced disability justice. So it primed me for being able to be an advocate once my daughter came along into the world. And so as I'm gathering more and more information about health equity, social justice, economic justice, things of that sort, and I've had a career at the intersection of clinical research and public health and criminal justice, I've been really curious to hear more about and talk more about how people with disabilities, Black people, young people, are more vulnerable to getting caught up in that school to prison pipeline. Can you share a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I think the initial label of being Black, regardless of disability status, already causes people to be vigilant and be looking for you to mess up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. But the second part of that is with people who have disabilities, they don't necessarily know or aren't trained to know, or don't really try to learn to know.
Or don't have the capacity.
Don't have the capacity to know kind of what's unique and nuanced for that particular individual. And so what happens is there's this rush to judgment, like rush to say, oh, well, whatever they do, they're going to be bad. They're bad kids, whatever the case may be. And it's all to feed into this like narrative that people are somehow incapable of, mm-hmm. you know, doing the right thing or learning or whatever the case may be. And I think, you know, it's something that it's wrong, but like it's going to be even more exacerbated and disproportional in Black communities because mm-hmm. they're already looking. Like I said, everybody, regardless of where you are, what race you are, what ethnicity you are, like crime is the same in all levels, right? When crime happens, right? But it's about where you're looking. So if you're already looking at Black people, you're like, I know they're going to mess up. And then you don't know that the person has a disability or you don't care. And the person has a disability, that's only going to make it worse. What I get really nervous about is things like involvement with law enforcement, right?
Mm.
Law enforcement, I'm going to try to say something nice about them before I say something bad. So the nice part is that law enforcement gets tasked with doing a lot of jobs that probably aren't law enforcement, right? Mm-hmm. So we task them with being first responders. We task them with analyzing the situation when they get there. We task them with keeping the community safe. We task them to get rid of the bad person who's doing something. Like, we put a lot on them, right? For not a lot of pay and for not a lot of training. So you know, we put a lot on them. But at the same time, what I also believe is law enforcement also comes into their job with certain expectations of different communities. Mm-hmm. And if they're not exposed to the community and they don't build relationships with people in the community, they don't know what's going on. They just want to be the big man with the gun, right? Mm-hmm. And in certain communities, you're not the only one with a gun. You know, it's going to be real hard for you to pull that off where everybody got them, right?
Yes.
So there's that. But then there's also, like, you have to be involved in the community to be able to recognize or understand when there is somebody who is dealing with a disability sometimes, because the community will tell you, like, oh, no, that's so-and-so. Like, we're good. But if you're not trying to hear that and you just rushing in guns blazing, that's when we get the major news stories that come out. The police officer is going to say, oh, I fear for my life, I this, I that. And the concern for us is always, like, why is it that you always in fear when that person is Black? Why is that fear not taken over to the other side of town where white people, right? Not that we want white people to, you know, go through bad things.
No.
It's more like, it can't always be us, right? You only scared when you over here. And so I think all of those things play into a factor. And I also think, you know, we have a rich history just nationally of otherism, right? We want to, in America, like, say that certain people have these limitations, be it based on race, ethnicity, be it on ability, be it on, you know, sexual preference, whatever the case may be. They have these limitations, and it all feeds into kind of a white supremacist construct, right? Yeah. The only person who's right is a heterosexual white male, right? That's the only person who's right. And so all this stuff feeds in, and what happens, and you see this really in, like, political season especially, like, all they do is put out ads that divide people just to make folks be like, oh, well, it's the immigrants that did it, or it's this that did it, so that you never focus on the true culprit that's taking your money and not giving you the service that you're paying for, right?
Amen.
So I think there are a lot of things we need to do to kind of fix that system. But for people who are specifically dealing with being Black and having a disability, I really think it's important upon us as all Black people to, like, foster a community of protection and understand we have to be our brother's keeper in a sense, because you know, we may know what people are struggling with, or we may at least be able to allude. If you see people, you interact with them on a daily basis, you know somebody who may be in that situation, and you're able to, like, voice or vocalize things for them in a way that they may not be able to do for themselves.
Right.
But I know also that's going to be a hard ask for people when the police come and they just looking for guilt, right?
Right.
It's going to be very few people going to be willing to take that step. You have to be brave and courageous to do that. And I think I've always viewed the community as being kind of an extension of myself.
Right.
So if I see somebody in trouble, it will be a lot easier for me to take that stance, only because I would feel like, okay, well, but for the grace of God, that would be me. Right. But it can't just be one person. It has to be the entire community being receptive.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that I'm an expert on all the disabilities, but I also know that there are some people who you are visibly understanding based on the way that they are emotionally giving cues, or, you know, some people, you know, they have a sense of touch, like, touch is the thing. You can pick up and you know when somebody is not trying to be, you know, disrespectful or mean, whatever the case may be, or violent. And I think it's important for us to all kind of galvanize and take up for each other.
Right. So you just, I appreciate you for going there with me and just kind of in our audience and shedding light on, you know, the vulnerabilities in our community. And then this special, you know, subpopulation that I hold near and dear to my heart. And I think a lot of us have a lot of compassion for and want to, you know, stand up and be protective of those people as much as is, you know, respectful. You know what I mean? Absolutely. So, you know, you've talked about so many aspects of our society, our community, And yet you're a lawyer, right? So, you know, I see so much of the things that I've been concerned about as a person with a psychology background, as a person with a public health background. Like, you know, when I came to Duke, I was really focused on population health. And so it just in your own mind, do you consider how your work as a lawyer affects public health and population health?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us why and how.
So the main thrust of the work that I do now involves evictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And evictions are a social determinant of health, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have stabilized housing. Everything else in your life is at jeopardy, including access to healthcare and all those things. And it's an additional stress. It's going to create more physiological issues anyway.
Yes.
So one of the things that I always tell people is with evictions, it's a symptom of like kind of how we view housing in America. Housing in America is viewed as a commodity, mm-hmm. not as a right. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is the people who have the money and resources to be able to buy housing or rent housing are going to be housed. And the people who don't, tough luck, right? And so what happens is all too often, developers who enter a housing market want to develop, but they're developing for a profit motive. So they're going to develop. I mean, we can find in the area I'm in now, there are tons of houses that are being sold for $1.5 to $2 million. But like, we don't have that, bro.
Not at all. You know,
for the people who are need something that is quote unquote affordable, there are not a lot of options. And that means that you're relegated to renting, which means that you're driving more demand into a rental market. So landlords see an opportunity for their prices to go up. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this stuff does is at a certain point, it makes the regular person who gets up, goes to work every day, may not necessarily have a high salary to be able to offset all these costs. It pushes them out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stay here. Good luck in Creedmoor. Good luck in Melbourne, right. Like whatever the case may be. But then if you have struggles there, you're probably also going to have a struggle in an area like North Carolina with transportation because
right.
you live in Creedmoor, but the job is in Durham. Nobody coming to get you. You got to drive yourself there. We don't have public transit that's going to get you everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot of things, and I always refer back to Durham just because Durham is an interesting case study. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know this, but W.E.B. Du Bois came to Durham at the turn of the century, right? And he was amazed by Durham. It was to him, it's like Black heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a place where Black people own hotels, restaurants, banks, medical centers, like all this stuff. And while it was still segregated from white society, we didn't have the issues of violence that all of the other cities in the South that are known had, right? We found a way to coexist and everybody have what they need.
Mm-hmm.
Until the 1970s and 80s, right? Like when they said we're going to build a highway through all the black communities and they're going to be gone and decimated or whatever. So my thought process has always been that is kind of the foundation of what Durham can be, right? Mm-hmm. We know we have people here who are business folks, who are innovative, whoever, you know, can do all kinds of things. But the issue is that when we got decimated, and plunged into the poverty of the 70s, 80s, 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened was there weren't resources from the city that would come in to be able to provide the things that people needed. Mm-hmm. So we were losing housing. People weren't getting housing. We also have a rich history of, it was an urban renewal program that attempted to say, give me your house, we'll build it up, we'll fix it, and then we'll give it back to you. But then they never gave people the houses back and they drove folks into relying on public housing system.
Yeah. Right?
So we've got that. But with all of this like history of what has happened in that time frame, what we have not done is really reach back to stabilize community first.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was we had a mayor who I actually like who said, you know what, the first thing we need to do is we need to get an economic infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Right. So what he said was anybody who comes into the area to develop or to bring their business here or whatever, we'll let y'all come in tax free. Right. So all these places ended up coming into Durham.
Mm-hmm.
But what he, I guess, had hoped was that they were going to train and hire Durham people to get those jobs. And they didn't.
Nope.
They just brought the people from New York, Seattle, wherever where they already paid way more in rent, brought them in here and was like, look, now you got rent for $800 a month for a two-bedroom, right? So mm-hmm. all these people came in. On top of that, you got two universities that are growing and expanding and bringing students from all over the nation. And students got student loans and all that stuff, so they can use that money to finance their lifestyle while they're in school. Mm-hmm. So all these things happen, and all these people come in injecting more and more money, but the city's not getting a taste of that money. So right. the people from the city who are like, hey, when can we get this? And the city's like, well, we got it right now. Just hold on. So I think that's the frustration. And like, especially with me, when I go to the barbershop, we had these conversations all the time. If you are somebody who's like mom and dad worked at Duke, you mm-hmm. love Duke, right? But if you're right. somebody whose family didn't work at Duke, you hate Duke because everything mm-hmm. got expensive, right? Mm-hmm. On top of that, I feel like there's a positive and negative correlation to Duke and Durham, right? Mm. So the negative is, if Duke really wanted to, they could just come out here, open the pocketbook, and be like, all right, it's now the city of Duke. You know what I'm saying? That's pretty much what they could right. do, right? Mm-hmm. They have been selective in some situations about scaling back from doing that, right? Right. But at the same time, the negatives are that you still do, right? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you're here, you bringing people with way more money here, mm-hmm. you driving up costs, you bringing students and God, buddy, driving up costs, and more so, you people who are associated with the Duke atmosphere aren't really receptive to the community that surrounds right. Duke, right? Because Durham has a rich history independent of Duke, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that causes a lot of friction that Duke and members of the community, like stakeholders in the community, have been trying to iron out for years. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, it seems like once we get four steps forward, there's five steps back when things like the light rail project.
Oh, Lord.
Stuff Kapoom. Like that gets vetoed by Duke. And it's like, mm-hmm. hey. But, you know, I think we've also seen Duke expand and be able to create jobs for people in the community, be able to demand certain housing, be able to bring in certain businesses and startups and all that stuff that hire from people in the community. So mm-hmm. the issue now is we're just trying to catch up. We're trying to get to a point where folks will want to invest in the community, but invest more so just in building a building and saying, okay, invest in training the people who are already here to be able to take these jobs that are higher paying and to stabilize our society so that everybody can feel included. Yeah. And I'm varying degrees of success on that, right? Like, I don't know that we'll necessarily get there in a short amount of time. And I think there's also, you know, some state interplay there, because whenever Durham starts being really, really progressive and moving forward, the state always slaps our hand to make sure we are reminded that we are not in charge. Mm-hmm. state is in charge. You know, I think that we've made strides to get back to where we are now, but we've got a long way to go to mm-hmm. be where we need to be.
Right. And, you know, considering both of us worked at Duke and we're from the Triangle, you know, I will jump in there and just say, you know, I've had some opinions, mm-hmm. you know, about not just Duke, but other large stakeholders in the Triangle, specifically Durham County, that are not what I consider calling their fair share either. Mm-hmm. And Duke is just a very convenient target for Absolutely. People. And I'm saying that they don't have a responsibility. I'm just saying, let's not be fooled into thinking that they're the only ones. And let's also not let our elected officials and mm-hmm. city and county government off the hook for Absolutely. Enforcing certain economic policies that would make it less of a choice and more of a requirement. Mm-hmm. And utilizing the different levers of investment back into the community that only the city and county can require. Thank you for joining us on Questions You Didn't Ask with me, Naisha Frey, and my guest, Jesse McCoy. Tune in next week as we continue our series, Justice or Just Us, How Law, Health, and Equity Collide in America.